From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, a con artist has been impersonating some prominent women in Hollywood, and she hasn't yet been caught. Then David Crosby gets real in a new documentary. It's produced by Cameron Crowe, whose interviews with a singer-songwriter forced Crosby to reflect on a whole lot of things.
Even though I don't want to admit I care what people think, it matters. It matters how I look at myself. And doing this has made it easier for me to look at myself.
And we catch up with Linda Ronstadt on her 73rd birthday. All that coming up on The Frame. Our first story is about a Hollywood hustle that sounds a bit like a plot from a movie. And at the center of it is one woman who's been dubbed the con queen. She's impersonated high-powered Hollywood executives such as former Sony Pictures co-chair Amy Pascal and Lucasfilm president Kathy Kennedy. Her victims include actors, photographers, makeup artists. She promises them jobs, but it's all a ripoff. For more, we have Scott Johnson. He's a senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter, and he's been investigating this story. He told us more about how the scheme works.
So there are a few different iterations of the scam, but the one that has attracted the most attention is the imposter pretends to be one of several very high-profile people, including Amy Pascal or Kathleen Kennedy, and in the guise of these famous people, gets in touch with up-and-coming industry professionals, be they actors, stunt people, and offers them a work opportunity that involves travel to Indonesia. And once they're in Indonesia, once they've been convinced that the offer is real and that they make the trip to Indonesia, they are then asked to pay for ancillary services that include things like driving, translating, and then that money disappears and the marks are never reimbursed.
The other thing that I think is notable is it's incredibly sophisticated and well done. This is not just like an email from some guy in Nairobi needing $1,000 to claim a lottery ticket. The voices are well impersonated. The research, there is a level of detail and thought that is put into this that I have to say is almost extraordinary.
It's really pretty remarkable because the imposter is really doing a lot of homework, getting to know the marks. Like, for instance, if she's targeting an Instagram photographer, you know, she'll be very familiar with the photographs, you know, where they've published, who they might have come across in their professional lives. When it comes to the people being impersonated, like the high-profile Hollywood people, the voice work is exceptionally well executed. Everything about it appears real and legitimate.
In your update, it feels like there are a couple of new developments. Let's deal with the most tawdry one first, and that is that the con queen appears to be trying to get people to engage in, I guess we can just call it what it is, phone sex. Is that always been part of the deal, or is it a little bit more aggressively and explicit now?
Yeah, so this is sort of another part of the scam, and it's been around for some time, but it appears to have sort of accelerated more recently. But basically, yes, it's phone sex. But this portion of the scam doesn't appear to have any financial element or financial gain. It's simply a bid to get people to do things that the con queen wants them to do. So there's a lot of elaborate performance involved. Very often, the con queen will ask people to, you know, quote unquote, audition for a role, which involves pretending to engage in risque conversation, sexually explicit conversation, a lot of sort of very risque language.
We're talking with Scott Johnson at The Hollywood Reporter about the con queen of Hollywood. The FBI has gotten involved. How might that change the investigation? And is it fair to say that some of the victims of the con queen have been a little reluctant to share their stories?
A lot of victims have been reluctant to share their stories. I mean, I think for a lot of them, it's embarrassing. A lot of them feel alone, that even though they know that other people have been victimized, they feel ashamed that they shouldn't have fallen for it. That's not obviously the case, but a lot of them feel that way. So what the FBI is doing now is trying to collect as much information as it can, and they've been helped in large part by the efforts of some private investigators, one in particular called K2 Intelligence, which has also been tracking the case for quite a while now.
And it sounds like some of the victims who might not have lost any money are nevertheless traumatized by what they have gone through. What are people telling you about how being conned, even if they've been tricked into some sort of sex phone call, have been affected by the con?
Some of the victims, especially those who've been lured to Indonesia, have literally lost tens of thousands of dollars in some cases. So for those people, the sense of betrayal is very deep and very real. And then more recently, the people who've been victimized in this sort of sexual catfishing scheme, and there's a lot of questioning that goes on, why me, that kind of a thing. And then I think lastly, for the people who've been impersonated, like Victoria Alonso of Marvel, you know, these are high profile people with big reputations to protect. And it's terrible to have their identities stolen and abused.
Here's my last question. It does feel like there is a show business aspect to this story, and that is that they are selling this dream of a job, of a contact. It's obviously a very competitive town to get work. Do you think that's true, that there's a unique show business aspect to this and preying on people's hopes to somehow rise above the pack and get a job?
I think it's very real. I think that you sort of hit it right on the head with this idea of dreams. A lot of these people, there was this sense of potential, whatever they were being asked to do, however outrageous or outlandish or costly even that it might have been, that perhaps on the other end of it, there would be something that could be potentially life-changing, you know, a great job, a lot of money, really great connections. And so in a sense, that's kind of the genius of the scam, is that it targets people in this particular vulnerability, which is their own hopes and dreams and desires and ambitions. And I think that's what has saddened so many of the people who've been impersonated, especially, is that their good names have been used to sort of betray the hopes and dreams of people who are trying to make it in a very tough industry.
Scott Johnson is a senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Scott, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on The Frame, David Crosby is the subject of a Warts and All documentary. David Crosby is best known for making music with Stephen Stills, Graham Nash, and Neil Young. And Crosby has pretty much torched his relationships with all of those colleagues and many more. Now his life, with its ups and many downs, including a stint in prison, is the subject of the new documentary, David Crosby, Remember My Name. The movie is produced by Cameron Crowe. He's the filmmaker behind Almost Famous and Jerry Maguire and was once a young rock journalist. The documentary's director is A.J. Eaton. I sat down with Eaton, Crowe, and Crosby after the movie had its world premiere at the Sundance Film Festival in January. We'll start with David Crosby.
They really did not give me any place to hide at all. They weren't merciless, but they were determined, because he's known me since he was 17. He knows everything that's happened. We've talked a lot. He's my friend.
Cameron, I want to ask you about your journalistic relationship with David. There's a point in the film where you pull out a tape that you have saved for many years. I think it's one of the first interviews that you did with David. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with David and why you had some questions that you still had left to ask?
Well, John, I ran into them, AJ and David, as they were just starting to talk to people about doing a documentary. And my feeling was, just looking at David, he's ready to talk. He's ready to go there. So I said to these guys, I'm doing other stuff, but just let me interview him, because I saw that look in his eyes. And that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to like give AJ interviews for his documentary. And I knew David from when I was 17. He was one of the first interviews I ever did. I was so grateful that he made the time to do it, because he didn't do interviews in the day. He kind of, you know, shined a little grace upon a kid journalist, right? So I had like so many questions for him. And I got through every one of them. He spent hours with me. I was 17. And these were the greatest answers ever. So I thought, you know, I'll come in, I'll do some interviews with these guys, And then the waters got so deep and the feelings got so rich, I became more and more involved with Glee.
But to make the film as honest as you want to make it, even if you're friends and even if you have great respect for David, it means you have to go to some places that are going to be uncomfortable. And it could be about busted relationships. It could be about something as painful to watch, and I think you'll agree, as you and Stephen and Graham singing Silent Night on some TV thing.
Yeah, it's all painful. Point was, are we going to duck that stuff and just put a ribbon on it and say, gee, David Crosby was so peachy keen? No. There's a story to be told, and we're not in it to put fluff out there. We did talk about some painful stuff, and yeah, that was a painful moment. They had our monitor mixes switched. Stills was hearing my monitor, and I was hearing his, so he couldn't get any pitch at all. So he was like wildly out of tune. It wasn't really his fault. It was a screw-up by the monitor mixer there. But it sounded like we felt.
It's a vivid moment in the film. I don't think David was sure we were going to use it or not.
I told him not to. They totally ignored me on everything like that. There's several places I said, do not do that.
I never heard that. So I was just so happy to have that in the film because it's so freaking real. But here, I just want to say, like, when we showed the film for the first time, there was such a real moment because David had not seen the movie. None of us had seen the movie with a big audience. And instead of somebody getting up there in a glib way saying, I'm glad you enjoyed my mea culpa film or something, he was still in shock. He was still in shock as he stood up there in front of the audience. And the audience got to see him processing what they'd just seen and were processing. And it was a remarkable moment to be like 7 feet away as you kind of realized that the audience was wrapping its arms around you. They were with you. And as you started to realize that and come into your answers, that, to me, that was the greatest experience of the whole process. So real.
AJ and Cameron, there are certain people who are central to the story, Joni Mitchell, Graham Nash. Did you try to talk to them? Did they not want to talk? How did you go about that?
We just made a conscientious decision that we wanted Crosby to be the sole narrator of his story. And we decided that we didn't want to do a big cavalcade of, oh, this person, oh, Crosby was this and that. We didn't want to do a bunch of talking heads. And so when we first put the first assembly together, we realized that those people and the portrait that Crosby paints with them in the movie, I didn't need that.
A lot of the people that he's worked with and his collaborators are still in our kind of circle of people that we know and work with. And many of them have reached out to us throughout and just said, just be honest. Say hi to David. Good luck.
We're talking with David Crosby, director AJ Eaton, and producer Cameron Crowe about the documentary David Crosby, Remember My Name. There are so many fractured relationships at the center of this story.
Yeah.
And there are fractured relationships that you had a large role in fracturing.
Yes.
You are making a movie where you're not only talking about those fractures, but you're hearing from the people whose relationships have been blown. So when you're watching the movie yourself and hearing what your former friends are saying about you, what is that like?
It's good. It's educational as hell. I don't think there's anything there I didn't know already, wasn't aware of already. The way we consider it in the documentary, I think, is the way we treated it, I thought was as good as we could. You know, we didn't slag anybody. We didn't blame anybody else. I'm more than willing to take blame for anything that happened in that group. I'll take more blame than anybody. But we all did horrible stuff to each other.
We as an audience watching this movie learn a lot about you, not just about your music, but about your life and about your health, about the people who are important to you. When you watch the movie, do you learn something about yourself that maybe you didn't quite recognize?
I learned how badly I want to be a decent human being and have that rep. Because I've been other than a decent human being, and it's not fun. I was a junkie. It doesn't get any lower than that.
Has it changed what you're going to do. Because at the end of the film, I think Cameron asks about, why don't you just show up at Neil Young's house and say, I'm sorry. And part of me, and I think anybody who's watching the movie is like, yeah, show up at his house, say you're sorry.
I'm already doing what I'm going to be doing. I'm making music the best I can, as fast as I can. And I apologize to Neil and more to Daryl, who's was the person I insulted, publicly as you can do it. I mean, it doesn't get more public than what's his name on the radio show?
The Howard Stern Show.
I had Neil Young in here 2-3 months ago, and he was distressed because you had said something about Daryl Hannah on social media. You know, Neil left his wife and started dating Daryl Hannah, and you were very critical of Daryl Hannah, you said.
I was, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? I'll tell you the truth about that. I shouldn't have done it, and here's the real reason why. I'm a screw-up. I have screwed up massively. Daryl Hannah never wound up in a Texas prison.
Right.
You know, I'm screwed up way worse than that girl. Where do I get off criticizing her? Where do I get off slagging her? She's making Neil happy.
Right.
You know, and I love Neil, and I want him happy.
Do you think
let me do this. Sure. It's the truth. Yeah. I apologize, Daryl. If you're out there, I had no right. I have nowhere to stand to look down on you and criticize you. I apologize. I should not have done that. It was completely out of line.
You know, you said you can't just show up on his front porch.
I can't do that. A, I don't know where he lives now. He lost his ranch in the divorce. So I the only place I know where he lived isn't there anymore.
You have such an interesting look on your face when you're asked that question in the film. I've always wanted to ask you since that moment, what are you thinking when you go, because I don't know where his doorstep is? And you're just looking at me like, I'm not sure.
Like, I think you know.
Interesting.
David, I'm going to ask you this last question. People who know you, know your music, maybe know something about your life. If they go into this movie and are changed by seeing it, and how they see you and how they understand you, how do you hope people might be changed and their understanding of you might be changed?
I would hope that they would think that I wasn't just a rambunctious asshole. You know, I would hope that they thought could see that there was a thought process behind most of what I did. Not all, but most. And I think that I'm a good lesson in the sense that I'm a very imperfect being. It's blatantly obvious. I'm also trying pretty hard to be a decent guy. And I think if people, you know, look at the guy that they're looking at in the movie, they're going to say, you know, this is a mixed bag. And I shouldn't judge people on one color. You know, people are not a single entity uniformly. They have all kinds of stuff in them. And I think when I look at my friends or my family or my wife or my child, that I got to understand. There's like good and bad and mistakes and courage and stupidity and all that stuff's in there. And it's not one picture. It's not one uniform person. And none of us are. You aren't, she isn't, he isn't. And that's a good lesson to learn.
That was David Crosby with filmmakers Cameron Crowe and A.J. Eaton. The documentary David Crosby, Remember My Name is in theaters on July 19th. Coming up after a short break, it's Linda Ronstadt's birthday, and she has a lot to celebrate. The singer Linda Ronstadt turned 73 today, but the celebration started a couple of weeks ago when she was honored by a cultural center in Los Angeles. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos was there, and he later spoke with Ronstadt about her influences and the album Live in Hollywood. It's a concert recording of hers from the early 1980s that was recently released.
I sat down with Linda Ronstadt at her hotel room the day after she was honored at La Plaza de Cultura y Artes, an art center in downtown L.A. Throughout her career, Ronstadt has received all kinds of major awards and recognition. But she says the celebration that took place at La Plaza was special.
I don't usually like things like that, but with Mexicans, it's fun. It's a different feeling. I feel like I'm at home.
Ronstadt's celebration was indeed close to home. Her uncle, José Ronstadt, shared a family story from the stage. In the late 1990s, in the middle of a concert in Tucson, the great Mexican ranchera singer Lola Beltrán stopped the show and asked a question.
Is Mr. Ronstadt here? Gilbert Ronstadt, Linda's dad. She asked Gilbert to come up to the front of the stage. She had beautiful sarapin rebozo blanco de seda. She took it away and she says, Mr. Ronstadt, on behalf of every Mexicano, I want you to give this to your daughter, Linda. It's because of Linda that the music of mariachi will never die.
Mexican music and culture have been a part of Ronstadt since she can remember. She was 8 years old when she first heard Beltran, who made a strong impression on her.
My dad would make a business trip to Mexico every year, and he'd always come back with a bunch of records. He'd bring back Trio Los Panchos, Los Calaveras, Pedro Tariacuri, Amalia Mendoza, Miguel Aceves Mejia, and Lola Beltran primarily. I just fell in love with her music.
In 1987 and again in 1991, Ronstadt released albums that paid homage to that music.
Mariquita se llamaba la que vive junto al río. Tápame con tu rebozo que ya me muero de frío.
When I wanted to become a professional singer, I wanted to learn those songs. And in those days, you couldn't look up on the internet, you know, and find it. I'd have a scratchy record for my dad. And I couldn't find the lyrics, and I don't speak Spanish, so I didn't know how to have a way to write them down and learn them from the record, so I just learned the melodies.
I'm going back someday, come what may to
the influence of Mexican music in her pop songs first appear in Roy Orbison's Blue Bayou, a song she recorded in 1977. Ronstadt says she was trying to channel the deep emotion of the Mexican singer she adored.
It just made me think of a Mexican song, especially that big chorus. And I had a hard time finding a resonance in American pop music because the rhythm culture is really black church at the time that we were doing it, you know, the late 60s and the early 70s.
Blue Bayou and 11 other songs are part of the album Live in Hollywood, recorded before a small audience in 1980. Ronstadt remembers vividly the night of the fabled concert.
I was in a television studio and it was a small audience and it was hotter than hell. It was just too hot to work. That's all I remember, just for sweating and trying to sing.
Ronstadt reminisced about the exciting time when she arrived in Los Angeles from Tucson. The Troubadour Club was at the heart of the music scene in the mid-1960s. She says anybody who played well hung out at the club, and it became like a big, close-knit family.
And Joni Mitchell and Carole King and Elton John and James Taylor, everybody, Neil Young, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, they all played the Troubadour. And so you got to hear him going. You got to hear him over several nights.
I read that recently in an article that you were there when Elton John made his debut at the Troubadour.
I was. He came in and sat in and did a guest set. It was crowded that night, so we were all standing up in the balcony. And I remember he came on stage and it was just like an explosion. But I saw Joni Mitchell there for 2 weeks. She played 2 weeks. I went and saw every single show, 2 shows a night, 3 shows on weekends. I went and saw every show she did. It was amazing.
Raindrops fall.
These days, Ronstadt rarely goes out to concerts. She retired in 2011 and was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2012.
But going into a big place is physically impossible for me. I go to the opera when I can get a chance, the opera and the ballet.
I asked Ronstadt if she's seen any young singers recently. When I mentioned La Marisol, lead vocalist of La Santa Cecilia, who performed at La Plaza, Ronstadt was excited to talk about her.
I love her. I've been stalking her on YouTube, and she's so honest. She's got a great voice, and she's dead serious about the music, and it just shows.
There's an upcoming documentary about Ronstadt's career. When I asked her about it, at first she appeared reluctant to comment.
I saw a rough cut. I didn't have anything to do with it. It's a weird feeling being examined that closely, you know. It was weird to watch it. It was like watching your whole life flash before your eyes.
I've been walked by the rain, driven by the snow, I'm drunk and dirty. Don't you know, but I'm still.
The documentary titled The Sound of My Voice is due out in September. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
And that's it for The Frame for this Monday. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.
And if you give me